This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know Pringles, the potato chips in a can? That, believe it or not, is a $2.7 billion brand. The NBA is trying real hard to capitalize on the Jeremy Lin brand. And what the?
Hello. I'm calling from Bank of the Universe.
No, not
we are
a good
banking
time.
On you.
And
we offer competitive
the future
rates
of robocalls.
And flexible loan terms. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the 15th of February. Good to have you with us. And we begin this Wednesday with the Do Not Call Registry. Remember that? The list you could sign up on to stop getting those unsolicited telemarketing robocalls conveniently right at dinner time. There were, of course, some loopholes. Say, a company you already had a relationship with. Or a call purely for informational purposes. They could still auto-dial you. I'm going to ignore that phone. Not anymore, though. The Federal Communications Commission announced new Do Not Call rules today. Businesses have to get written permission from you before they can do it. And what?
Hello, I'm Daniel. I'm calling from Sunshine Cruises Limited.
We telemarketers have to include a way for you to opt
to
out during
St.
the call.
Kitts,
maybe something kind of like this.
Press 1 or 5 if you do not want me to ever call you again.
Sadly, though, the new rules apply only to robocalls, which means a live body can still try to get you on the phone, even at dinner time.
This is Daniel again. Why'd you hang up on me? I'm a living, breathing human being. I have feelings. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, I'm just waiting for the phone to ring again. All right, so here's your today's You Have Got to Be Kidding Me business story. Kellogg's said this morning it's going to pay $2.7 billion to buy Pringles from Procter & Gamble. $2.7 billion for potato chips in a can. If that seems like a lot of cash for a processed, loaded with salt snack at a time when people are paying more attention than ever to what's in the foods that they eat, yeah, we thought so too. So we asked Marketplace's Amy Scott to find out what gives.
Oh, sorry. Just a second. Wow, I usually save these for road trips. But Robert Pasikoff with consulting firm Brand Keys says plenty of people indulge when they want to.
While most consumers know that they ought to eat more healthy foods, you know, they're still dipping their hands into bags of salty snacks.
Or in this case, cans. Lots of them. Pringles did about $1.5 billion in global sales last year. It's the fourth biggest snack brand in the world. Marketing consultant Jonathan Salem Baskin says Pringles has been expanding its offerings lately.
There are umpty-ump versions of Pringles with jalapeno peppers, with extra salt.
I think he's kidding about that one, but there are multigrain versions and honey mustard, even soft-shell crab in Asia. The deal will make Kellogg the second largest savory snack maker after PepsiCo and give it another advantage in the grocery store, more shelf space.
So if Kellogg's owns Pringles, it owns that access to that space.
Baskin says the deal may be an odd fit since Kellogg promotes itself as a healthier cereal company with brands like Special K and Rice Krispies. But he says Kellogg should let Pringles stay Pringles.
Pringles actually should just embrace its inner bad self so that if and when it's time to enjoy that comfort food of identically shaped potato processed something or another's, Pringles is the go-to choice.
So maybe the mustached guy on the can should trade in his bow tie for a leather jacket.
Why not?
Oh, yeah. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I don't know. I'm not a Pringles guy. Regular chips for me. All right. The basketball world has been abuzz this past week with what has come to be called Linsanity, the New York basketball world in particular. Jeremy Lin is the overnight sensation of the New York Knicks and the NBA. Since coming off the bench 6 games ago, he's been so hot that even fans from opposing teams are cheering for him and buying his jerseys, which is a problem for a guy nobody had ever heard of this time last week. Marketplace's Sally Herships has the story.
A couple of weeks ago, Jeremy Lin was sleeping on a friend's couch. He'd been benched by the Houston Rockets, the Golden State Warriors, and his current team, the New York Knicks. Then some of his teammates got injured. Lin got his chance and made plays like this.
5-4. Lin for the win! Got it!
Last night, the Knicks were tied with the Toronto Raptors when Lin sunk a 3-pointer to win the game. Welcome to the Linsanity. Nigel Murray works at Modell's Sporting Goods in Midtown Manhattan. He says when a shipment of Lin jerseys came in, they sold out in the first hour.
Everything was gone. You know, t-shirts came in, were gone. Jerseys came in, they were gone. Kids stuff, people were trying on the kids stuff and just buying it, you know, right on the spot. It was gone.
The NBA says Jeremy Lin jerseys are still sold out.
Sports in general are emotive. Everyone loves an underdog as well as even more so than that, a humble underdog.
Chris Linchinsky runs Front Row Marketing.
You're looking at an underdog story of huge proportions beyond the fact that he's the first Chinese descent American-born player in the NBA.
The Knicks says Jeremy Lin's name is the number one search for term on Baidu, the Chinese equivalent of Google. Patrick Risch is a sports economist at Webster University in St. Louis. He says the Knicks television network, MSG, has seen a boost in its stock since Lin started playing 10 days ago.
And MSG Network has seen its ratings increase by 70% since his star has begun to shine.
The NBA says outside of New York, ticket sales at arenas where Lin is playing are up 17%. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, two things helped bring the major indices down. First of all, Apple topped out before lunch at $525-some-odd a share. Then it was all downhill to the close. And two, speaking of downhills, that's where the prospects for a Greek bailout seem to be headed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so we're not actually going to wait until the numbers to bring you the Greece story. There was supposed to be another meeting today in Brussels, face-to-face, for the European Union to talk again about the latest Greek bailout package. It got downgraded to a conference call, at which the possibility of waiting until April to decide anything was apparently raised. We'll have some more on what a Greek default on the $450 billion it owes might mean for banks in a couple of minutes. But first, Marketplace's Stephen Beard from Athens, where a lot of Greeks are wondering what happened to all that money they borrowed in the first place.
It's a question you hear a lot in Athens today.
Where is the money? Everybody's asking where is the money. Where is this money?
Lawmaker Liana Kanelli is one of the many Greeks who wonder what happened to the 360 billion euros borrowed by successive Greek governments.
Where the hell is the money?
Well, some of it was spent down here at the Athens Olympic Park, built for the Olympic Games in 2004. Once a sparkling facility, now it's a symbol of Greece's economic decline.
Look at this. This is all fenced off here. And this gate is chained with a rusty chain, so that means it has been here for quite a long time. It hasn't opened.
Christos Karanatsis, a theatre director, worked here as a volunteer during the Olympics 8 years ago. Like many Greeks then, he was caught up in the pride and exuberance of the occasion. Today he looks at the dilapidated park in dismay.
It looks all very deserted. It's a deserted scene. There's graffiti on the walls. It is a very different sight from what it was 8 years ago when it was clean and full of life and hope.
Christos worked as a guide and played the role of a Greek fisherman in the opening ceremony. At the time, he was proud of the panache, extravagance and success of the Athens Olympics. Today, he wonders whether the Games played a part in Greece's present misery.
possibly they went over the top with it in order to showcase to the rest of the world that we can do it the way you do it. And as a result, now we're in the debt crisis.
Not so, says Spiros Kapralos, head of the Hellenic Olympics Committee. He says the Games cost around 8 billion euros, $10 billion today, and that's a tiny fraction of the Greek debt load.
In a country that has a debt of 360 billion, the 8 billion is minimal. One should look how we managed to get the other 352 billion.
So where did the money go? Well, it went into many less glamorous enterprises. Athens Central Station, part of the state-owned Greek rail network. Former finance minister Stefanos Manos says it's been one of Europe's costliest railroads, with more employees than passengers. Staff earn an average salary of $90,000. When he was in office, Manos came to a startling conclusion.
We would spend less if we would send every individual passenger to his destination by taxi.
So where did all the money go? Manos says it was pumped into a bloated bureaucracy, into fat salaries for key public workers, into their early retirement, into an overstaffed and inefficient education system, into a country living beyond its means.
If you go around Greece, you don't get the feeling that this is a poor country. So the money went all around and circulated, but it was all borrowed money. And that is a problem.
Not everyone in Greece accepts his analysis, but the rest of the European Union and the International Monetary Fund certainly do. That's why they insist the Greeks commit to steep cuts and curbs in public spending before they lend them a single extra cent. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So about the banks and what Greece's economic problems might mean for them. The answer is, it might not mean much. This morning, BNP Paribas, the biggest bank in France, and also, as it happens, one of the lenders trying to work out a deal with Athens, reported that its profits fell by more than half last quarter. The hit came, in part, because BNP had sliced about 75% off the value of the Greek debt that it owns, the bonds. Markets pretty much took that in stride, surprisingly enough. So we asked Marketplace's John Dimsdale to see if there's a lesson in there somewhere.
Private banks and hedge funds that own Greek debt have known for some time they're not going to get all their money back. The president of Greylock Capital, Hans Humes, sits on the committee that's negotiating a deal between private debt holders and Greece. He says right now they've proposed that Greece pay them 50 cents on the dollar. And he calls BNP Paribas' decision to write down even more than that prudent.
And I think 75% is a good proactive conservative approach for a large European financial institution to take, and they could easily get some recovery beyond that.
European markets seem to agree as bank stocks jumped today on the BNP Paribas news. The French bank is a key player in the Greek debt talks. But David Blanchflower, a former Bank of England official, questions whether a 75% write-down is enough.
The reality is that there is no growth in Greece. GDP fell by 7% the last year. There is no possible way that the Greek economy can pay any of this stuff back.
Plus, he's concerned about possible debt defaults in other European nations.
The question is, could you even stop it at Portugal? Very closely behind, if you like, is Spain and Italy. Could you stop it at Greece? Could you prevent it even getting as far as France?
For the moment, though, investors feel France's biggest bank is taking the right steps to protect itself from Europe's debt crisis. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There's a deal brewing in Congress to extend the payroll tax cuts through the end of the year. It will also provide continued jobless benefits for the long-term unemployed. It is, you can safely say, a rare instance of economic bipartisanship in Washington. And commentator Betsy Stevenson says that's great, for starters.
The U.S. used to be a dynamic labor market where people got back on their feet quickly after losing a job. Most people who lost their jobs found work within 8 weeks prior to the recession. In this context, our unemployment insurance system made sense. We support folks who draw the unlucky straw and are laid off. But because in the past, most who searched could find work quickly, we only provide support for up to 6 months. And our unemployment insurance system isn't really focused on helping people back into jobs. But this system doesn't work for us today. Today, a majority of the unemployed haven't found work, despite having searched for more than 21 weeks. Millions remain unemployed when their usual 26 weeks of unemployment benefits expire. But the ongoing debate in Congress over extending the number of weeks of benefits has come at a serious cost. It has crowded out an important discussion about how best to reform our unemployment insurance system. For example, we know that giving unemployed workers job search assistance speeds the time to finding a job. That reduces how much time we pay them benefits. In fact, randomized trials show that this assistance saves the taxpayer more money than it costs. And there are surely other reforms that could help people back to work and maybe even save us money. But the debate is bogged down in politicians fighting over the basics, whether to give the unemployed a lifeline, rather than over how best to do it. We need to discuss and fund ideas that will make our unemployment insurance system more successful in helping the unemployed find jobs. After all, what we all really want is for everyone who wants to work to be able to work.
Betsy Stevenson used to be the chief economist at the Department of Labor. In real life, she teaches business and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Let us know what you think when you get a minute. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up.
Other than maybe handshakes or grabbing a handle on a bus just after someone else has, this is sort of the top three or four way that we exchange each other's communicable goodies.
Dirty, dirty money. But first, let's do the numbers. Why, yes, yes, it was Greece again today. The Dow Industrials fell 97 points, 0.75%, finished at 12,780. The Nasdaq lost 16 points, around 0.5%, 29.15. The number, the S&P 500 lopped off 7 points, 0.5%. The final number there, 13.43. You'd almost think today's report of improved factory output in December and January never happened at all. Those numbers didn't meet Wall Street's expectations, and some key Dow components tumbled as a result. Take 3M. That third M, by the way, is for manufacturing, but its shares slipped nearly 0.5%. Boeing descended a similar margin. Caterpillar shares dug down more than 1.5%. Bond prices edged up. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.93%. The name of the show is Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for January. A House Appropriations Subcommittee holds a hearing on the quality of life in the military. And beam me to Broadway, where William Shatner's one-man show opens, Shatner's World. We just live in it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Clearly, it's been a busy couple of days for the Federal Communications Commission. Not only were there the robocall rules we were telling you about, but the FCC has also announced that it's going to essentially kill what could eventually have been the start of a national wireless network known as LightSquared. Eliza Krigman's been covering the whole thing for Politico. She joins us now from Capitol Hill. Eliza, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I have to tell you, until this morning, I had never heard of LightSquared. Tell us what that company is and what the whole plan was.
Right. That's understandable. There's a lot of people who hadn't heard about them. They are a broadband company, and they own satellite spectrum. And they had a grand plan to launch a commercial network that could have been a competitor to Verizon and AT&T and more traditional carriers by repurposing the satellite network for land-based transmissions that we need for cell phones and smartphones and the devices that we love to use.
And it would have been Wi-Fi, right? This would have been a national Wi-Fi system.
It would not have necessarily been a Wi-Fi and a wholesale network. It would have been a new model for the wireless industry where if somebody wanted to, for instance, create their own ebook, instead of having to go through Verizon or AT&T, they could have purchased the airwaves needed to power that device on a wholesale basis for a lower cost from LightSquared had they been successful.
Gotcha. And then it eventually rolls out to the consumer. But the FCC says, no, you can't do that. Why?
Exactly. They have interference problems with GPS. Where they own airwaves is next to where GPS operates, and they've been involved in a year-long battle with the GPS industry, with Congress, but ultimately the government is now unanimous in its position that there's no practical solution to the interference problem. So the FCC has proposed revoking the authority it would need to move forward with the commercial network and has set a prohibition on them operating, period. So
Right. Basically,
the conventional wisdom is it's game over.
That's because obviously if you don't have the FCC's permission, you can't do things in the spectrum. But let me just ask a very basic question. Don't I have the ability on my smartphone, even though, yes, it's not an iPhone, can't I get Wi-Fi and a GPS at the same time?
It's not about whether Wi-Fi and GPS are compatible. It's about whether the specific network they were proposing on the airwaves they owned would interfere with GPS. That network never turned on. But the facts, at least according to the government, show that if they did, it would interrupt GPS signals.
Got it. So can we now then take it to be that if LightSquared is doomed, what happens then for some cheaper, nationally based, you know, broadband, conceivably convertible to Wi-Fi kind of system?
That's a great question, and the answer is unknown right now, but clearly it's a problem. You know, consumers, LightSquared would certainly say at least, have lost here because they were going to be offering a cheaper network, but the commission remains committed to moving forward with public policy changes that will make it easier for new entrants in the future to be able to accomplish such plans, but it's far from clear how long that will take, and it's a bit discouraging for new entrants.
Yeah, so eventually maybe, but not right now, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Eliza Krigman, she's a technology reporter at Politico. Eliza, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All right, humor me for a minute and take a look in your wallet. What do you got? 10, maybe 20 bucks, maybe more? Money. It's the bills we pay. It's the debt we're in. It's the paycheck we get every week or two. But day to day in our wallets, mostly it's cash. David Woolman's been thinking about cash a lot lately, and he doesn't like it one little bit. His new book on the topic is called, appropriately enough, The End of Money. David, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Kai.
Why do you want to take our money away, man?
Well, so the project began when I got curious about this campaign to get rid of the penny. But then the argument started to resonate with me, and I said, well, wait a minute, why just the penny? What about the nickel and the quarter and the $10 bill? I decided, well, I'll try to not use and not even touch cash for an entire year, and let's see how that would go, whether it's at the parking meter or traveling overseas. You know, there are very legitimate arguments to be made in defense of cash, but what I wanted to do was subject it to a little bit of scrutiny because it seems to have skated by for centuries now without anybody wondering, well, what are the real costs here?
Well, let's do that. Let's just tick down the list. And first of all, as you have pointed out, cash is not cheap. It's an expensive way to conduct transactions.
Right. So first of all, you have to get it out there to the world, to all those ATMs and cash registers. And then you have to secure it and maybe move it some more and count it and make sure that your employees aren't skimming off the top. Then you have cash as the currency of crime. 2009, 2010, there were like 10,000 bank robberies just in America.
Oh, yeah. So if you didn't need banks to put your cash in, you wouldn't have bank robberies, right?
Right. And in Sweden, in fact, you have this union of bank worker employees saying, let's get rid of cash altogether because they're tired of the hazard of robberies.
There's another thing that you go into in some depth in the book, and it becomes a little bit your, okay, this is a strong word, obsession as you went about your experiment with living cashless for a while in this society. And it's a thing that our mothers always told us when we were kids, and we were like, wait, what do you mean money's dirty? I mean, it's just filthy.
It really is. I mean, other than maybe handshakes or grabbing a handle on a bus just after someone else has, this is sort of the top three or four way that we exchange each other's communicable goodies. And there's a wild study that some Swiss researchers had conducted trying to see how much they could grow the influenza virus on some dirty, humid banknotes in a dark and scary place.
Well, wait, how did it go?
It grew surprisingly fast. But then I shipped that study off to a friend at the CDC, and she said, look, you know, unless you're literally blowing your nose right into it and putting it in a humid wallet and not letting it rub up against a bunch of other leather, maybe, only maybe, would the virus remain intact.
There's a socioeconomic part of this as well, though, right? If you get rid of cash, which is among the key ways that people who don't have a lot of money spend money— then if you go all electronic, whether it's credit cards or mobile payments or whatever, aren't you kind of disenfranchising them?
If you get rid of cash tomorrow, yes, absolutely. The doormen and the waiters of the world out there are probably not loving this idea. But in the long term, if you can imagine 10, 15, 20 years from now, if a substitute technology or technologies is really there, then you're actually helping the 99% who are kind of stuck in the cash economy. And if you are excluded from the formal economy, you can't have a bank account. You can't earn credit to maybe later get a student loan or get a mortgage. You're stuck with cash stuffed in a tea canister in your apartment that you hope somebody isn't going to steal. So that's sort of the idea that I was probing. But you're absolutely right. This would be foolhardy if we outlawed cash tomorrow.
David Wolman, his book is called The End of Money. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Hi, it's Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace. If you value the service we provide, if you think this public radio station is important in your community, please consider donating. No, you guys, we can't do that. Wasn't anybody listening at the top of the show? Unbelievable. All right, we got to go before the FCC gets us. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 97 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ pulled back 16 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 slipped around the same margin, carved off 7 points. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for more tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.